This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. If I've got my numbers correct, this is episode 687. Oh, and I do have to just drive home and get this done because this is our last small group meeting, which is pretty amazing because I think I probably mentioned back in September that the whole small group thing sort of came as a surprise. My wife is on staff at the church where our son-in-law is the pastor and my daughter is the mother superior, as I'm fond of saying. And my beloved just came home one day and she said, yeah, by the way, we're going to be leading a small group. And I was like, what? Because, you know, there is some time involved there, and I thought my schedule was as packed as it could possibly be. But, you know, a little less sleep, you can make things work. So I was fascinated to see how this was all going to work out, because the schedule with the writing, especially, is such that if I miss my window, once my window escapes of got to do a book every 6 months, once I miss that window, basically the whole schedule slides 6 months. I mean, there's no way to make it up, because beta readers are supposed to get their copies on April the 1st and October the 1st, actually mid-September if I can, because it has to be back to me by June so that I can release it in July, and likewise it has to be back before Thanksgiving so that I can get it done before Christmas, because if you hand a book to beta readers after Thanksgiving, nothing is going to happen. Nothing is going to happen. I mean, if you hand it to them mid-November, nothing is going to happen, because the holidays just get so busy. So the only chance you've got of actually getting something... Wow, there is a guy walking a beautiful white dog. It's just absolutely gorgeous dog. I don't know what kind it is, but it's gorgeous. If you don't get a book to beta readers before Thanksgiving, specifically so that they can be finished before Thanksgiving, chances are it ain't gonna happen. So that's really kind of an unmovable thing there, that it has to be 6 to 8 weeks before Thanksgiving. I have to get it to them, because most beta readers, I give my beta readers 6 to 8 weeks, and that seems to work out pretty good. I've got some people that just turn around in a couple of weeks and they're done. I've got some people who just sit down and hammer through it, and they're done within days. But most beta readers, you know, need 4 weeks, 5 weeks, somewhere in there. You have to give them 6 to 8 weeks. It's a little better. Kind of relaxes the process a little bit. You know, you're not just driving people forward. So once you've got that 6 to 8 week boundary that has to land before Thanksgiving, and so my target is to have everything back in by November 15th to give people a little bit slop. If you're going to get 2 books done a year, then that's basically October 1st. You got to have the beta ready by October 1st. And if you're going to do 2 a year and they're spaced out by 6 months, that back times it to April 1st. And that's it. And the schedule cannot slide. Because if the schedule slides in the fall and you get into like December 1st or November 1st, maybe you'll get some of that stuff back, but it's not going to happen. And that's going to bounce everything forward. And so now you're in a situation where we've got a roadblock ahead here. And people are merging. So you're in a situation where if you miss that window, you might as well just wrap it up and wait for 6 months and hop back on the next time. So, you know, beta preparation happens. Beta preparation is supposed to happen March 1st and mid-August-ish. No later than September 1st. So it's March 1st and September 1st or if I can back it up into mid-August even after. So the goal is, like the sprint I'm in now, the goal really would be to get to 85,000 words or so. I've been had lots of costume stuff. So I'm going to hit 80,000. I'm hoping I can get it pushed up to 85,000. That way, when I come back on the backside, the books run about 150,000 words. Now I've got 7 weeks of writing sprint. That puts me about a week ahead, blah, 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 blah. So yeah, there's a lot of shuffling and there's a lot of points I have to hit. So when Nett came home and announced, oh, by the way, we're leading a small group, I've just kind of looked at her for a minute and said, okay. But God's been good. He's been helping. We've been having our small groups, enjoyed our small groups. Good. Lovely. It's been a good time. So hopefully people have enjoyed it. And with that as our last one is this evening. And then we go on our summer schedule, which our summer schedule will be that we're only getting together for fellowship once a month. So we're just going to have a meal together and, you know, we'll gab and talk about this, that, and the other. And then we'll start back up in September. So we'll start up in September. So it's good. It's good. It's good. It's good. Anyways, so all is well there. All is well with the writing. I have been shaving off a little time and, you know, because I'm really needing to get the National Fairy Day costume done by June 1st so that I can get back to being Angel Day. I really have to get back to being Angel Day. Because I've got a ton of stuff that I have to do there. My phone is really getting buzzed a lot. I don't know what's going on here. Buzz, 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 buzz. Okay, it's all people coming and going from our house. So, must be packages getting delivered. So, all is well with the writing. I think I know where I'm going. You know, the stuff is forming up. So far, so good. It feels like it's all kind of moving along, which is good. I think I know where I'm going with this, and it may be pretty dramatic. We'll see. We're in the last set of last 8 books. And we haven't had anybody die for a while. Well, as far as a main character, we haven't had anybody die for a while. And I just have a feeling it's about time for somebody to die. So, you know, I don't, despite my laughter, I don't approach that lightly. Because I still have 8 books to go. But, yeah. Yeah. So maybe we'll see. It's kind of percolating up that might be. But we'll ride it out. We'll see what happens. We'll go from there. Anyway, so that's all good. Costume is coming fine. I think I stand a fighting chance of getting the National Fairy Day costume done by June 1st. Because I probably can get the rest of the stuff written to get to 80,000 words over Friday and Saturday, and then I don't need to start the preparation for the production version of book 16 until June 1st, which means I have Labor Day, and I have most of the evening Friday, most of the evening Saturday, and most of the evening Sunday. And I pretty much got the top and the skirt put together, and I know what I'm doing for the rest of it. There's a bunch of little busy work that I have to do, but 4 or 5 hours of that. I still have to make shoes, and I still have to make the wings. So, but I've got all the materials in to make the wings, and I know how to make the wings. I've watched the tutorials. It doesn't seem like it's that hard. So I'm thinking we should be pretty close on this. So that's the plan. That's the plan. So all is good there. And all is well with the family. And God is good and He is kind. And I think I'm Oh, I may have this Sunday off at church. I'm not sure I have anything going this Sunday. So it's good. It's good. This week, I was going to talk about something else. And then I came across a YouTube video that I had seen popping up in my feed a couple of times. But I was like, Then I finally just clicked on it and thought, yeah, let's watch this. And the name of this video on YouTube is The Surprising Relevance of Engineering in Biology. Now then, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not going to cover everything in this video because this video is 40 minutes long. And I only have about 10 more minutes. So what I really like about this video is it agrees with me, which of course that's always a plus when you find things that agree with something that you've been saying for decades. For decades, I've been telling people, literally decades, I've been telling people about what I believed are the three waves of science. Because science of itself does not establish a morality. Science simply exists as an investigation. Science helps us build things. Science helps us develop treatments and those kind of things. But whether or not we should use those tools, whether or not we should engage in those treatments, those are other questions. And in many cases, those questions come down to a morality that is underneath it. So, because of that, you really need more than just science. Now, I know we have made an effort in this country to do away with God and just worship our technology. No question about that. And we thought that everyone was so noble that every scientist would be doing the best science they could. And if the coronavirus pandemic has shown us anything, is that there are a whole lot of forces working in the world that are not necessarily doing what's best, they're doing what makes the most money. So science, hopefully this is becoming apparent to people, science, good science, cannot be done without a moral framework, without something that orders our path and tells us what we should be doing. So once you remove that moral framework and you've got science going along, science can just like completely go off the rail. People can do bad experiments and claim they're good experiments. They can hide data, they can skew data, they can do all sorts of things. And if you don't believe that, just follow up with some of the trials and do some real research on some of the things that have been done with some drugs that appear to be efficacious for things like coronavirus that are really cheap. And because they're really cheap and they would have stopped people from making a lot of money, oh, lo and behold, no one wants to look at these trials. And when they actually do trials, they do unexplainable things that self-sabotages the trial. And so it's really fascinating. So there's science for you. Now then, what that means is because science doesn't have a moral code and that it's going to inherit whatever the moral framework is that exists for the person who is trying to conduct the science, then it should be no surprise that when we get into things like evolutionary biology, because many of the people who are engaging in evolutionary biology are looking for an excuse to deny the existence of God, it should not surprise us at all that they conclude that they have found everything that they need in evolutionary biology to show that this all was just happenstance and random. Okay, that's not a surprise. But I have maintained for decades that, in fact, there is going to be three stages of science, three waves of science. The first wave is really just an imitation. And what we have is early man looking around going, oh, there's an animal. I'll draw a picture of an animal. Ta-da! I have drawn a picture of an animal. Wow, that's just like the animal. Or I take a little clay and I model this animal and I just say, wow, look, I've made an animal. You know, that's not that hard. I just can't make it move yet, but I'll figure out how to make it move because it can't be that complicated. So the first phase is really that imitation, observation, looking and looking and looking. The second phase is when man begins to get deeper into this and starts doing autopsies and starts seeing all this complexity and starts going, whoa, there's a lot of stuff that's going on in here. And while man may have an appreciation for the beauty of nature and for those things, and there might be whispers in his soul telling him that there is someone out there when he is in the imitation observation stage, once he gets into this complexity stage, he starts to get nervous because if there is someone out there designing all this stuff, it exists at a far higher level of comprehension and ability than he is. And I maintain that that distance, seeing all of a sudden that what's happening inside a horse is phenomenally complicated, that makes the man feel small. And so the second phase of science is really kind of a realization phase, where man realizes the complexity. That complexity makes him feel small. And out of that smallness, then he decides that it all just has to be happenstance, happenstance and chance. That it's all just something that kind of got started, and he misinterprets things like adaptation. And he says, oh, well, that should apply to everything because it's easier because of Occam's razor. Well, I'm sure that this little adaptation over here could just be magnified, and that's the simplest solution. Therefore, everything came about just by gradual change. Because apparently, from their observations, they look at things and they say, oh, yeah, well, see, that just shows like that's just unplanned because that doesn't look like something, and this doesn't look like something, and that doesn't look like something, and this just looks like it's just filled with mistakes. Because they are interpreting through their lens of this is obviously something that came about by itself because I don't want to imagine a creator that could actually create all this stuff. And so I shy away from that. Therefore, it has to be by chance. Therefore, I find all kinds of things to actually reinforce the idea that it came about by chance. But what's interesting about this presentation, and this is by a person who is a Christian, who believes in a great designer, believes in a great architect, is that he was noting that as we have moved forward, the evolutionary biologists are actually enlisting the help of engineers. And the only way they're coming to a better understanding of how certain mechanisms work within living creatures is by using engineering principles. And then they're ignoring the fact of what the conclusion must be after you come to that, but that's the third wave. And the third wave of science, as far as I'm concerned, is that not only does man discover the complexity, but he discovers such amazing, deep, beautiful complexity that it simply makes no sense any longer to believe that it wasn't designed. And we're on the cusp of that now. And in fact, the guy in this YouTube presentation that's called The Surprising Relevance of Engineering and Biology, he's making this presentation to say, yes, the evolutionary biologists are actually discussing things with engineers to figure out why this is actually designed pretty well when they thought originally that it wasn't. So, for instance, one of the big dings that the evolutionary biologists who don't want to believe in a God give against, like, the human eye is they say, oh, this is terribly designed. It's just terribly designed. is the fact that the retina is turned backwards. That the eye doesn't actually strike the retina, it bounces off the back of the eyeball and goes into the retina. And they say, see, that's terrible design. It should be flipped around the other way so you get better light coming into it. But the photoreceptor should just be there. And that's what people argue. Or they say, like the panda's thumb. You look at the panda's thumb and it's just terrible. There's all these extra bones in there. They don't need all those extra bones. What's wrong with you? Well, first of all, it is hubris to realize that you don't actually understand a system completely, which you're willing to pass judgment on it anyways. And that should tell you that the judgment that you are passing has nothing to do with the facts. It has to do with your precognitions about, preconceptions about how things are supposed to be. So, you know, these have been two big things. Well, actually, somebody said, what's happening as engineers have worked with the biologists is that biologists have actually looked at systems more carefully and they've realized that what they once thought was poorly designed, they now know is optimally designed. Like the photoreceptors have to face backwards because the photoreceptors are constantly shedding the cones. If they face forward, they would block vision and all the shedding. They would block the vision from all the shedding, so they would have to face backwards so the cones can be reabsorbed into the tissue. And they also need cooling from the blood in the tissue. And he said, in addition, photoreceptors have fiber optic cables. There's actually cells that act like fiber optic cables that take the light directly to the photoreceptors in the retina. So again, you see this is exquisite optimal design that everybody just brushed off because they took one glance at it. I'm getting my mail. And they said, oh, those are facing backwards. That's a bad design. When they didn't even understand the design from the first place. He said the same thing about the panda's thumb. He said, you know, the biologist looked at the panda's thumb and said, well, that's terrible design. Look at all those extra bones. There's no need for all those bones. But he said the same thing is true with the panda's thumb when people who have looked at it more carefully realize that the panda's thumb is ideally designed to eat things like bamboo. So it's optimally designed for a particular habitat. And so, and the problem is, he says, researchers looking at the photoreceptors realized that they had an assumption of poor design because they were only looking at one variable and they weren't looking at the system as a whole. And that when you start looking at the system as a whole, then all of a sudden, some of these things start making far more sense. Okay, I gotta finish up here. He said, it's disappointing how often people are allowed to misrepresent the science to the public, so long as they're trying to suppress the evidence for design. It's very disappointing, but the evidence is going the other way. And of course, one of the most significant examples is the ENCODE project, because people would always say, well, yeah, look at DNA. Look at all the junk DNA in there, all that junk DNA. This just shows that nature was trying all kinds of different things and it just discarded most of it. So they were saying, well, there's like 90%, 97% of the human genome was non-functional. Because according to evolutionary theory, that's what they would find. And so they were expecting to find that. Except now, with the ENCODE project, they found it's actually functional. That the more they study it, the more what they used to think is junk DNA are things like pseudogenes and retroviral elements, endogenous retroviruses or things like, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That this all does do something. Of course, now, if you've got 3 billion base pairs in DNA and it all does something, now you're talking about a really, really complex system. And so it's a really interesting talk. He was also mentioning that there's a wonderful paper on labyrinth fishes. And when you read this paper, what they did is they studied the jaws of the fishes. And he threw it up there and he said they have in their jaws, from a biomechanical standpoint, a system of levers and linkages that transmit the force of contracting muscles to the jaws. And it's a 4-bar linkage. which he says is an engineering design that's used in bolt cutters and typewriter keys and heavy construction. It's many other human machines use this four-bar linkage, and it's right there in the fish because it's very, very well designed. And I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. And it's really, you know, it's fascinating because as the engineers, you know, look closer and closer about these things, they find that this business of gradual change, he was saying, this business of gradually things growing and growing and growing, that's not what's supported in the fossil record. What's supported in the fossil record is what some have come to call punctuated equilibrium, where you have this sudden appearance of this completely different new system. The Cambrian explosion is where a lot of this happens, where everything's going along, and then bam, you get these multicellular organisms that are all different body types. They're all different designs. You know, they all work. And then from that, you get these minor variations as it goes forward. And he said one of the ways to look at this is that these minor variations are not necessarily huge changes to these subsystems. In fact, what they are is they are part of the system's ability to adapt. And I have said this for years, that what we're talking about when we say evolution, I said, whenever I hear that term, I just exchange designed for adaptation into that term. And in fact, he talked about that in this article as well. So that he said, let's see if we can find one that makes sense here. He said, you see the same thing in stickleback fishes. He said, what used to be thought as an absolute win for microevolution was that cavefish, you have cavefish and they've fished, you know, they've swum around so long in the dark that they've been at no need for their eyes, and so their eyes disappear and they become blind. And he said, except what you find when you raise cavefish in water with low conductivity, there's a sensor that senses the conductivity of the water, and it sends a signal to development to shut down the productions of the eyes, because that leaves more room for other sensors. But if you raise those fish in more turbulent water, you can and raise them in different light conditions, their bodies respond to those physical conditions in ways that are unique to those fish. And let's see, you end up with, you know, they form eyes, although I don't see this right here. What he was saying is that what you see in stuff that we think was evolution was not actually evolution. It was built into the system as adaptations. So he said, like beetles, when they get around, I think it's army ants or fire ants or something, it actually triggers certain things that makes them appear to the fire ants as if they're fire ants. So by their scent and by how they move and those types of things. And so there's all this stuff that's going on that is really exquisite design from an engineering standpoint. And even within that engineering standpoint, there are designed adaptations to help the species survive. And we ain't there yet. We're not to the point, you know, where scientists are willing to say, yeah, there's just no way this is going to happen by itself. We aren't there yet, but we're getting there. We are in the process of moving forward with that third wave of science, because the more the engineers get involved, I just can't see how it could possibly come to a point where the engineers don't just look at the biologist and say, yeah, you know, you don't have enough time to create this kind of exquisite design. You just ain't got it. Now, how long it takes us to get there, I don't know. Obviously, religious inclination is one of the deepest and strongest systems in us. And when people have made a commitment to believing, because it's more convenient for them to believe, that there is no designer, they're going to hold on to that for a long, long time. But there'll be some. You know, as they're falling asleep, as they're getting up in the morning and they're looking at this gorgeous, optimally designed complexity, there'll be some that will begin to reach out. And then the fun thing is, Jesus will start talking to them. And there will be this little voice inside them that's talking to them and drawing them to himself, because Jesus loves us so much. He will patiently wait, as we work through all the other explanations for how things might be without him, until we finally get to the place where we say, yeah, you know, there has got to be a designer on all of this. And he is spectacular. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.